Hello everyone, I am Mirta Hurtado Rivas. No VIPs or rock stars, just simple people sharing their life stories to trigger discussions around important topics, or simply to inspire us to embrace challenges ourselves. Welcome to Leaderching. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Leaderching. My guest today is Milan Milojevic, founding partner of the law firm MSA, located in Belgrade. Ciao Milan, kako si?
Dobro sam, Mirta, kako si ti?
Sve u redu, sve u redu, hvala. Nažalost, moj srpski nije dovoljno dobar za razgovor. So we have to switch.
Odličan je.
We have to switch to English, unfortunately, because I should practice my Serbian more often.
It is perfect, Mirta, really. So, but I guess it's for the sake of all our listeners, it is perhaps better to switch to English.
Definitely. So thanks so much, Milan, for being here with me today. And I suggest we just directly dive into my first question. And that is, I am wondering, what did you want to become when you were a child? Did you have any dreams?
Yes, of course. I think we all had dreams, and mine were not very different from, I think, many boys of my age at that time. I wanted to become a football star, which unfortunately, due to my kind of a physical, let's say, not best characteristics, I never achieved to be. And then afterwards, I wanted to become a fireman, and that didn't work out as well. And I guess that I ended up being a lawyer.
So that's interesting, actually. I find it interesting that you first wanted to be a football star and then a fireman. I know a lot of boys who wanted to be a fireman when they were smaller. So tell me, did your environment or your family kind of influence your dreams when you were a boy? So did kind of the football thing come from somewhere, or is it just because it was something, it was common at your time?
Well, I guess it's both, right? I mean, of course, you know, boys in a kind of a don't forget, I was raised in a socialist or communist Yugoslavia, so most of the sports we're playing were team sports. We were playing, you know, in the yard behind the building where I was born and raised, or in the park, or in the, you know, in the school. So that was the most common sport that we literally used every chance to play. And also, I must say that my father, who was in his youth, he was a basketball player of Partizan Belgrade. So he was really a big fan of Partizan. And he, when since I was very, very young, he was taking me to the Partizan soccer games, where I get, let's say, familiar with that environment, with the football players, with the fans all around. And in a way, this was a parallel. That the dream world that every boy is living, right? So you had your school, you had your homework, and so on. And I was living for a Sunday to go with my dad and one or two of his friends to watch a football game on the stadium. And I still remember that impression when you enter into the stadium and you see the big green field in front of you, and just before the game, it is like if you are moving from one world to another. So I guess that was the reason why I really wanted to kind of feel and be part of that wonderful sport world.
Okay, that's interesting, actually, that you mentioned. So it had also a family connotation. You just mentioned that you were brought up in former Yugoslavia. It was, as you just said, a socialist country. And you mentioned also that team sports were a big thing at the time. Was there a particular reason for that? I'm not sure that our listeners know.
Well, yes, I think that part of that culture, right, not to call it ideology or politics, but it is around the strength of the collective and of a team, right? So it was not about the individualism. It was not about, you know, nowadays we have some great tennis players and so on. But back in the days, that literally didn't exist, right? It was all about a team and how much we need to rely on each other, how much we need to sacrifice our individual, maybe also, I would say, benefits or what we have, right, capacities for the team. And how much is important also for victory, not to be a victory of one person on its own, but a victory of a team. Of course, you could easily then imagine how this was reflected also on a country and on a kind of that cultural and ideological background that we were living in.
Yes, obviously, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for sharing that. I wonder, you mentioned then afterwards that you ended up being a lawyer. So what is it that make you choose law school finally when you had to make a decision as to what you wanted to become?
That's a very nice question. And just before I answer, there is another reason around the collective sports. We were also a poor country, right? So we couldn't really, play golf and tennis. I wasn't really aware of any of these. So let's just be realistic and say also the other reason for that. But aside of that, sorry.
Thank you for mentioning that. No, I think it's important because,
I think
yeah, it makes,
it is fair to say.
yeah, and it makes a big difference because I think our days, football still continues to be one of the favorite sports in the countries where there is not much financial means because you just need a ball. That's essentially for
Exactly.
it. Yeah, no, fully understand.
Exactly.
Thanks for sharing that.
And but answering to your question, there was no really particular reason why I didn't really have any particular reason or dream around when I entered the law faculty. I don't come from a family with a legal background, so that was a little bit of a surprise also for the family that I actually enrolled myself into the law faculty. The reason was that basically I was a big fan of history in my high school days, and still am in a way. And I really wanted to study something where I would still have some contact with the history, because that was one of the topics that I really enjoyed. And I thought that, without a clear vision as to what will I become after the finish the law faculty, I was thinking, hey, what I can do, it's kind of a combine what is the things that I like, and that is history in a way, and many options that ones can have once you finish the law faculty. So at that time I was thinking maybe a judge, maybe a lawyer, maybe just working in some company, so as we all know, the law faculty does offer a vast variety of options to work in once you finish the university.
Thanks for that. So let me further ask you. So you studied law. How did you end up finding out that IP would be something that you wanted to do in the long term?
Well, that's a pure coincidence, Mirta, I have to say now, and I hope that nobody will hold this against me. But I finished the law faculty, and basically I got a first job offer, which was in an IP firm, and it was very tough times in Serbia. We're talking about 95, 96. That was during the economic embargo, and literally economy was almost non-existent when we're talking about big law firms or big companies in Serbia. So there are very few law firms that were, still working, and one of those were IP law firms, because they were relying so much on the foreign IP owners who were still protecting their rights in that time, Yugoslavia. So I got an offer from basically a father of a friend of mine, who asked me to join his firm, as he considered me to be a person of trust, which I consider to be a great honor. And to be honest with you, I didn't hesitate for a moment.
I must admit that I am someone who ended up in IP as well by coincidence. So you're not the only one. And I think sometimes it's actually weird when you think back as to how many years we've been in IP and in comparison to young professionals our days that have done, IP already during their studies and then they have masters in it. I always feel weird because at my time, for instance, IP wasn't a course that you could select at my university. It came only much later. So, but I think, things happen for a reason, even if it's for a coincidence, right?
Same goes for me. So to be honest with you, I mean, IP wasn't, we were studying about IP, but very little. And it wasn't something that kind of a random student of the law faculty in Belgrade would think of as of his kind of a future job. and passion. And as you said, there was really very few, I would say, professionals, IP professionals at that time. So that could be also the reason why we didn't really choose. If maybe we were faced with more options around IP, maybe we would choose it during university. But simply being a really kind of a rare profession to be in the IP at those days, I think that it was that coincidence and fortuna factor was needed. But you know, once you're there by coincidence, as it is the case for you and me, I think that we both fall in love with IP, and now I wouldn't doubt it a second, and I wouldn't change my profession for any other alternative that would show up.
Yes, same here. I think that's once you get into it, I think it's like something that ignites your passion, your curiosity, and then it's actually nonstop continuing of learning, and that's why I love IP so much. So now let me we were talking earlier on about the fact that you were brought up in a socialist country, and my next couple of questions will be related to leadership. And I was wondering if the fact that you had been brought up in Yugoslavia may have had an incidence as to what you believe good leadership is and the characteristics that a good leader should bring with her or him.
Well, I'm sure it does, right? And I mean, it is also, now easy to be smart and say, hey, this was in the, in the socialist country, it was this or that. Also, it makes it a little bit difficult to talk about this because we all know that that kind of a ideology and political system is now past, right? It doesn't exist, maybe, at least not in Europe, and at least not in that form that existed maybe 30 or 40 years ago. But yet, I mean, we should not forget some of the, I would like to think, good sides of it, or maybe we just all remember our childhood with some good memories. But when it comes to the leadership, I think that kind of equality, really, which was really something which was nourished in Yugoslavia, in the schools that I attended, it was very important, right? So it doesn't matter your social status, it doesn't matter your even kind of what your parents are doing or not doing, or what are they working. It doesn't matter also in the school, what is if someone is having better grades or lower grades. I think that the system was really insisting on that equality. And you could also feel, even being just a child, you can also feel that the system was insisting on this equality outside of that. So talking about my parents and so on. So I would think there is a broad middle class that existed, lower or upper middle class, but basically the middle class was the one that was kind of a really governing the society. And in a way, you could be a director of a company or just being someone of physical worker, but there would be certain sense of equality, which I think helps also being a leader, right? Because you try to see the world from the shoes of everyone in your team. You don't try to kind of distinguish yourself, and you try also to understand all the burden and all the hard work that everybody in the team has to perform on a day-to-day basis.
I think what you're saying is that obviously, if you learn, right, how to place yourself in someone else's shoes, and if you get to learn already that not only your perspective is a valid one, obviously that makes a much more open leadership style, right? A much more inclusive and engaging leadership style, rather than a just top-down, very kind of, kind of I'm the boss and I'm always right. So I think I can, it resonates with me in the sense of I always believe it's important to not remember that there is always two sides to a coin, or that there is always, more than just one perspective based on what you see. And especially in law, right, where it's all about being right or finding the right solution according to the law, it's actually very clear that depending on how you look at facts and how you look at what is needed from your client side, that will change a lot. So
Absolutely. So,
Let's
and
see.
maybe if I can add
Sure.
to that, Mirta. So yes, that's absolutely one angle and extremely important, right? So that in a way we are smarter by listening to others and respecting their views and opinions on a certain matter, so we don't have that monopoly of truth, right? The other is also to respect the other's work, right? So sometimes I think that leaders have a tendency of thinking that they are doing the hardest work, and then the others are, in a way, doing something less important or something like that. And I don't think that's the case, right? I think that sometimes also for the leaders, it would be extremely difficult to, work, as any other member of the team. Maybe goes vice versa, but I think it's about understanding that everyone's work is equally important, equally difficult, or maybe sometimes even more difficult, and also and challenging, right? So I think that's also part of that understanding each other and being in other shoes.
I think that makes a lot of sense to me also from the perspective of trust. You see, because for me, one of the elements that I believe makes a big difference in leadership is how a leader is able to establish trust with his or her associates. And I think for trust to be built up, to have space to actually grow, I think one of the things it's to exactly that, it's to respect each other's role within a team. And I believe, at least from my end, I always think it makes a lot of sense to sometimes just try to do someone else's job, to see how difficult it is. So, for instance, when you need to review a process or set up something new, it's very easy for us leaders sometimes to forget that actually we may have these wonderful ideas about what efficiency means, but that actually those that need to contribute and should have a say as to how this needs to look and be done is actually the ones doing it. And as long as we don't kind of from time to time get our hands dirty and try to understand a tool or a software or do stuff that we haven't done for many years, then it's easy for us to forget actually that there is complexity. It's not because one role is set up in a so-called hierarchy, right? And it's a hierarchy actually that's designed by ourselves, right? It's not something that's nature given, that you may get lost when you do that. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I combine it with trust. I'm not sure if you see a trust element there
No,
too.
trust is a needed element, right? Because in a way, as you said, instead of us, going and exercising each one of these job descriptions, right? We rely and trust to the people doing it, and I think we need to listen to them, hear them when they say, "Hey, this is possible. This is not possible. No, I need more time. No, I need less time." And these are the things, right, that we need to rely on their word and their expertise, because they are indeed the experts, right? And that's I would say that each one of these job positions is in a way is a cornerstone of a team, right? So and we cannot go and test each and every of those jobs and tasks. So basically we need to trust these people, and it, not these people, but actually our team members, our colleagues, our friends. And be sure that that's basically we, with that trust, we are building something, a coherent unity, and only then we can be really efficient, we can deliver the targets that we need, and so on and so on. So indeed, it is a trusted relationship.
Thank you. I'm happy we're aligned. you just mentioned one of the keywords. Actually, you mentioned two things that I would like our listeners to think about a little bit. The first thing that you mentioned was that when you take someone else's perspective, it's actually you need to listen, right? And you need to listen is not simply just sitting there or on a Zoom call or whatever, but it's really listening and then actively trying to understand, right? It's two different things. Listen is one, but then trying to really understand and follow the other person. And I'm just highlighting this because I think that very often when we talk about leadership, we always say, listen to better understand. But I think it's also the understanding that it's the important one, right? It's really be open-minded enough to really take the time to see what the other person means. And this is very important for this initiative for LeaderChain, where we try actually with the conversations, we try just to share how other people see some of these elements like leadership or equality. And then, this sharing element for me is important.
Well, I think when we talk about leadership, Mirta, I mean, of course, many books have been written, and I'm definitely no smarter than anyone else, being on this podcast with you. But I guess each one of us has a certain idea about, in terms of leadership, how we personally perceive leadership. So I think, in a way, for me, leadership consists of two segments. One segment is really, in a way, and it's both in terms of communication with the team, right? So one segment is communicating with the team. What is the target? What we are trying to achieve? What is the added value and the quality we want to bring, by year end, or whatever we set ourselves as a kind of a end of a certain project, be it kind of a annual plan, be it just a kind of a project. And we share that, and we say, "Hey, this is what we want to achieve, and let's make sure that each one of us, is first of all agreed around that target and a goal. That we all see what is the value behind that goal, so that we're just not doing it as for a reason that somebody set the goal, but we understand that goal and we agree that this is the right thing to do. And then we set up who and how is going to contribute to reach that goal. And the second segment is really about the leader, being there on that journey and literally offering their help and service, right? Talking to the team members and saying, "Hey, what can I do more for you to help you achieve what we agreed is our common goal?" So first is really sharing, and the second is really offering assistance, if you ask me. And I think so far I have implemented it, and it came just naturally. But if I start to think about analyzing that process, I would maybe say that these are those two components that worked out well.
Yes, I like the idea about assistance, in particular when it's about, which type of obstacles can we take away so that every team member, every colleague can perform at its best, right? It's often enough, it's not only about helping, but often enough, it's about taking away some bureaucracy, making things more accessible, being more flexible. And I think if we
Exactly.
can add to that, right? I think that is really, as you say, that is kind of the accompanying role of being there throughout the entire journey, right? Is being serving the team and not so much the team serving maybe the leader.
Exactly.
So you mentioned another thing, obviously, and this, you know me for a while now, so you know that this is very something that's very close to my heart, but you mentioned equality before. And as you know, gender equality is something that I like to talk about. Now, I'm wondering, I've heard that in socialist countries, this played out somewhat differently than in other countries. For instance, when I was visiting Slovenia during my first years and my current role, I saw a big difference of how many women were actually in, high-level leadership positions, how much the country had actually arranged for children care and so on. So I'm wondering, what's your view? Is there still room for improvement with respect to gender equality, for instance, now in Serbia?
Well, I think there is always room for improvement, because there are some, I would say, modern social phenomenon, or maybe, also something that comes from older days that they're still existent, particularly, sometimes the gender violence, it's still happening, and we need to definitely stop that. And I don't think that it's something which is genuine to Serbia. I think it happens in literally every country of the world. But you're right when you said about the gender equality and in the socialist countries. To be honest with you, I mean, it was not such a big issue for us, right? Because in a way, we were raised in on that equality premises. And you're right about Slovenia. You know, I remember, I think Yugoslavia was one of the first countries having a prime minister being a woman. I think that also the suffrage, the right for the women to vote, was firstly introduced, you know, in the socialist countries and so on. So obviously, I think there was another talking about those positive heritage from those society is that gender equality, which was in a way genuine and real, and I think that's also something that we need to cherish, right? But having said that, there is no room for a break or for a pause. We need to continue. Struggling and making sure that, you know, that gender equality prevails, and that whatever are the challenges, as I said at the beginning, there are still few. We need to tackle them and make sure that you know, there is literally no difference as to when we speak about a different job, when we speak about communication and treatment in the family, in the society, in the school, at the job, salary ranges and so on between women and men.
Definitely, I couldn't agree more. And I know that this is also valid for the entire, not only gender, male and female, but also for any LGBTQI plus, you know, also minorities. They may need our support to continue to achieve equality, you know, in day-to-day life.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's something that also, you know, Serbia is, that's maybe, I must say that it's a little bit more of an issue. I must, you know, we need to speak openly. And for Serbia, you know, we have been in the wars in the 90s, and I think still some minority rights and so on have been questioned back then. A lot has been done since then, but I think much more needs to be done also in order to really, you know, put that wound away, make it scar well, and live a better future. And of course, that also go for the LGBT population, which, by the way, I think you know, has the situation has dramatically improved during the last 10 years. And I would like to think that this is really the new generations coming and educating maybe some more conservative circles. I don't know if you're aware, but the Serbian Prime Minister Ana Brnabic, she's already known and declared, you know, member of the LGBT population. So, and that has been now widely accepted by the society. And I think this is really a great step towards a better future for Serbia.
Excellent. Now, I think it's really important to share, particularly because, as you mentioned, we know that it has not always been the case. So seeing that this is happening is obviously a lot of encouragement for the next generation and for us to continue, as you said, to fight for this. Now, I know that normally I should be asking you my last question now, but obviously I cannot let you go without speaking about Serbia as a country itself. As you know, it's a country that I have become very kind of linked to in a very special way, not only by the fact that a lot of my friends are there, but also because there is a lot of commonalities, which is so weird, with Latin America, where my parents come from, right?
Yes.
So it's really funny, right, that such a different country in a different continent, but there is still so many, I would say, in particular, emotions are similar in Latin America and in the Balkans, which is really funny. But not to make this too long, I just wanted to hear from you, you know, based, and maybe I can first start by saying this, the first time I went to Serbia, and the same is valid probably for the first time I went to Slovenia, for me, those countries were like kind of mentally, right, so far away from my reality that I was so impressed by the type of professionals that you can find there, the diversity of backgrounds that you can find, and particularly also about the ambition and the drive that the young generation has to really, you know, improve their life, but also their country's actually destiny, I think. So I just wanted to hear from you. Now that you have been with your business back in Serbia for a while now, How do you perceive that? What makes the drive so different than maybe countries in Western Europe?
Well, that's a good question, Mita. And it's I don't have really a simple answer to that. You know, we can think about different factors that have influenced this, but obviously, I think that that Serbia comes, as I mentioned earlier, and it goes for the other countries of former Yugoslavia, from a relatively tough period in the 90s and maybe early 200. It has established relatively impoverished background, right? And as a result, a lot of the people have actually, you know, they couldn't really count on their future in the country, and they were either looking to go outside or staying and maybe simply without big hopes of working in a kind of a Western European environment. However, what they have shown whenever the opportunity came, and I think that we have seen also with the MSA or also, you know, working for Novartis, is that when they see an opportunity where they can really show their talents, show their education, and where they can really see that, you know, that there is maybe a room or where they can also, you know, work together with their Western European colleagues, they really want to use this opportunity and show their capacities and maybe show to the world that they are not, you know, by no means forgotten, that they're not kind of in any educational, intellectual, language skills, and so on, behind the rest of the Western Europe. And of course, they want to embrace this opportunity and show to the world, hey, here I am, and you know, I'm worth something, and I'm really happy for the opportunity given, and I would love to continue working with you. And I think that's basically as at least that's how I see it. For me, this has been really a great journey for the last 9 years. It's now 9 years that I moved back to Serbia, and I've met really now I can say hundreds of young people, professionals who have become my colleagues. I can see, you know, the energy, the hunger, maybe is also the word sometimes, but in a very positive sense of that word, hunger, energy, enthusiasm, and hunger for a better future, of course. It's something that I would say qualify them all. And I do hope that, you know, this sentiment will still, you know, still exist in the years to come, in order to, you know, bring these people and my country forward.
Thank you so much for sharing that, and I fully agree with you. And I think it's the right word to call it hunger. It's really like that. So now I will just jump over to my last question, and that is, if you could go back to your 20s and give some advice to yourself, what would you tell Milan to do differently, or you know, maybe you will tell him to do this in the same way. But what is it that you would advise yourself?
Oh, that's a tough. Well, definitely, I would say myself, it was better to meet Mirta as soon as possible, and then, you know, you can. I think I learned so much from you. You know, so I think that if that meeting has happened earlier, then I would be even better in what I do. That's at least one thing. And the other thing is, well, back in the 20s, it's hard to say, right? To judge and say what we did wrong and what to. But I would assume that probably I would, with some small different changes, differences, I would still go to the West and learn about some working habits and so on, how the kind of also the IP industry works, and then come back to Serbia and build what it is. And I'm sure that there are probably, you know, many mistakes that I've done. But you know, I also think that what is done is done, and that basically I'm actually quite satisfied as the things have turned up. They could have turned up in a much worse way, particularly if we think about, as I said, all the issues that existed when I was in 20s in former Yugoslavia. So I couldn't think of a better future, to be honest with you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Milan. I don't have much to add to that. First of all, obviously, you're extremely kind with saying that meeting each other earlier would have
That
had
that's
an
true.
impact
That's true.
But in any case, there is one thing obviously that I wish, and that's for all of us to go back to some type of normal so that we can finally meet in person and, have some cevapcici and some rakia sitting outside on a terrace in Belgrade. I think that's something that I'm looking very, very, very much forward to.
Absolutely.
So, hvala puno, Milan, ovo je bilo divno. Thanks so much for being my guest today and for sharing a very kind of, private view, personal view on how you have, what you think about leadership, but also about your own, life, getting back to Serbia and setting some things up there. Thank you.
Hvala tebi, Mirta. It's been a really wonderful talk, and you managed to take some words from me that I, literally, didn't share, never maybe. And again, I think this is a great initiative. I've been listening to your podcasts, and I think that's great what you do. And I'm obviously honored, to be your guest today. Thank you.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you liked this episode of Leadaching in English. Don't forget to give us a thumbs up on your respective platform and subscribe to our podcast. See you soon!
Les habla Mirta Hurtado Rivas. Bienvenidos a otro episodio de Leadaching Reco. Este episodio lo dedicamos a las elecciones presidenciales.